Welcome to Civilly Speaking with host Sean Harris. Each month, Civilly Speaking brings you interviews on practical and timely legal issues on the local and national level. We hope you enjoy today's show.
Hello, I'm your host Sean Harris, and welcome to a very special episode of Civilly Speaking, brought to you by the Ohio Association for Justice. Today is August 21st, and this is our 50th episode. In recognition of this milestone, we are very excited and honored to have with us Dr. David Ball, co-founder of the Reptilian Trial Advocacy Method and the nation's most influential trial consultant. David, thank you very much for joining us here on Civilly Speaking.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Now, the first question I have for you is in a personal injury case, when should I suspect that my client has unsuspected brain damage? And by the way, I'll note that that question uses the word brain damage and not brain injury.
Well, let's not spend too much time on that distinction. You can have brain damage from things other than injury is the difference in meaning. So perhaps I should have I should talk about injury because we're talking about injuries. And the reason that is a very important question is it's one of a group, and I'm going to talk about several of them today. It's one of a group of injuries that I would say most lawyers ignore most of the time because they look at the injury, the patient's injury, the way the patient comes in, the client, I mean, and it never occurs to them that this kind of injury could be accompanied by brain damage. Somebody, for example, something terrible falls on their leg and it crushes their leg, and who would suspect brain damage? The fact is that virtually anything that's serious enough to injure anybody catastrophically, that just means inside the body, and even if something that does not touch your client, such as a very loud noise, can cause brain injury. So the crash of a car crash, the noise can be loud enough to cause some brain damage. That's one of the less usual ways it happens. But impacts being heavily jarred, you cannot tell from where the injury is on the body whether or not it also damaged the brain. Similarly, you cannot tell by talking to the person the way that whether or not they have brain damage, because most kinds of brain damage, unless they're massive, manifest themselves in ways that aren't going to just come up sitting in your office having a conversation or even with a doctor. No one can tell just by looking. One of the quick ways to find out, this will sound silly, but it's true, one of the very first things that a brain injury damages is a person's sense of smell. So the next time your client is in your office or even at intake, have an open jar of peanut butter hidden away in your office someplace under your desk and ask them if they smell anything. And if they don't, they may have brain damage. That doesn't mean they do have brain damage, but it's a very high indicator. And I just want people to stop ignoring the possibility of brain damage. I've worked on too many cases where we come in and we suggest it because frequently we're hired to consult, you know, after things like discovery are over. We generally like to start earlier and determine the person has brain damage. Well, brain damage adds a decimal or two, decimal place or two to the verdict because it's such a serious injury and you can show it to be so massive, massive in terms of how it affects the client. So please don't get out of the habit of ignoring it. You can develop a local doctor or somebody who can examine the patient for you. It doesn't have to be a witness in trial whenever they don't pass the peanut butter test. And there's other little ways you can tell, but you cannot tell by talking and you can do them. I don't care how perceptive you are, how much brain damage you see, you might spot it when it's there, but you cannot rule it out just by looking. Nobody can. No scientist, doctor, or anyone else can rule out brain damage just by looking. Similarly, and let me jump into another very related topic, there's a whole huge range of injuries that are ignored in case after case after case. So when we get involved early enough, fortunately it's time enough, if it's early, to get those things put into the case where they belong. And, you know, we get involved a little bit later after discovery and after the reports are in, it's a lot harder to do that. But what I'm talking about is what are the long-term consequences of the injury the person has. I don't care what kind of injury it is. If it is a long-term or permanent injury or even in some cases when it seems like a shorter-term injury that got better, there can be long-term damages. And before I go into how do you find them and what they are, if there's a possibility of long-term harm, you need not prove it beyond preponderance. That's not the standard at all, because it goes to non-economic damages. If the client is worried, has anxiety, has reason to be worried about potential future long-term consequences of something that happened to them because of the defendant, the fact that your client is worried about them means that the worry about them goes to emotional damages, non-economic damages. And the worry that, will I have the X amount of dollars to pay for the care if that happens, that also goes to non-economic damages, because I'm worried that I won't, and then what will happen to me. And so the jury can remove that worry. Remember, you're dealing with a non-economic damage. The worry, the jury can remove the worry of, say, early senility. Can't remove the early senility, but you can remove the worry of how will I support myself if that happens to me, by simply providing that much money to take the worry away. So you've got a hard dollar figure, or at least a not-so-soft dollar figure, attached to non-economic damages. Now, what am I talking about? Well, for example, if your client is paralyzed and sitting down in a wheelchair, their risk of cancer and heart disease go up higher than if they started smoking. That's pretty hefty. We warn everybody don't smoke, but we don't seem to worry about them too much when they're in a wheelchair. Or for that matter, you sitting in your office chair all day long, it also raises the chances of bad things happening, among them heart disease, cancer, things like that. So everything has its long-term problems. If you have a typical neck problem where there is nerve damage, be aware that a damaged nerve can, in the long run, damage nerves that run alongside that nerve. And that nerve can go any place in the body. So a damaged nerve in the neck can spread to other nerves, and those can spread beyond that. If you need an explanation of that, take a look at a chapter by Jeffrey Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, in a book called Reptile in the Mist. Many of you probably have that book. Take a look at that chapter, and it will teach you about what happens with nerves. And since nerves are involved in so many injuries, nerve damage of some sort, this too is something for your client to worry about. If your client is in a lot of pain, it interferes with their sleep. It either interferes with their sleep because they're in pain, or it interferes with their sleep because they're on meds to help with the pain. Either way, people are not getting normal sleep. Even if they're getting their 7 or 8 hours sleep, it is not normal sleep anymore, because the pain is either meaning you're sleeping less soundly, or the meds are what is allowing you to sleep, and that the meds themselves interfere with getting normal sleep. The consequences of intruded upon sleep are enormous. They will lead to early senility. Whatever kind of dementia you are going to get, you will get it earlier. It can cause all kinds of problems. Do your own research on this. I'm going quickly today, so I'm not going to go into detail about this, but there is a website, one of several, that report on all the research that's going on and currently being reported on all over the country, all over the world for that fact. It's called Science Daily. ScienceDaily.com has got a good search engine. You look up things like sitting down all day or bad sleep or whatever, and it'll give you all the really good research that's coming along. So don't neglect that. And third, are the long-term consequences. And don't neglect, for permanent or long-term injuries, your patient worried that when the invention comes along that might help him, whatever it is, for example, we can now get quadriplegic and even fully paralyzed people back up and walking. It is incredibly expensive, and it's cumbersome, but less and less so, but it's there, and it's getting better, and it will be available to the public within the next, 5, 10, 12, 15 years, but it's going to cost a fortune. Your client worries about, Jesus, the worst thing I can imagine for myself emotionally is to know something like that is out there. I apologize for saying Jesus. I'm trying to break my habit of offending people by using the Lord's name in vain. I, you know, never affected me, but it affects friends, so I'm trying to stop doing it. The client will say, I can't imagine anything making me feel worse than knowing my pain could stop tomorrow. I could be up and walking in a week and not have the money to do it. So again, all that goes to non-economic damages. If your patient can show that the whatever it is, the worry of a future harm of some sort, or not having the money to be able to take advantage of what everyone else can take advantage of, the advances of medical science or whatever, you can talk about those things. And whether or not, and you usually will, but whether or not that successfully you get a bunch of money for it, you may get money for something else, because it helps to show the jury how awful the injuries really are, not just the current ones. And that's terrible. The thought that you'll be worse in the future is really hard for people to take. We're all used to being sick and being hurt and thinking, well, I'll be over this someday, but not this person. And so that makes the entire case a much more serious event for the jurors in terms of your client. And that, in turn, makes the negligence seem that much more egregious, because it caused so much harm, not just the suspected harm that you saw when the patient walked into the office, when the client walked into the office. Okay, so those are the areas, the main areas of future damages that if you get nothing else out of anything you hear today, start looking at that. It adds decimal points to your verdicts, and it helps your clients in ways they might not even know they need at this point.
And that's a great point. I hear clients lots of times when they're talking about worries in the future, speaking in terms of precautions that they have to take, that they know regular activities they would have been able to do without thinking about it. Now, before they go for a walk, play with the grandkids, whatever it is, they have to think a couple steps ahead.
And they have to think that since I'm much more prone to being injured again, for example, if somebody does have brain damage, a second trauma of equal proportion hurts vastly more than the first. If, in other words, become an expert on the future. You're not reading crystal balls. There's so much experience and research out there. You can show that what's suspected as an whatever the level of injuries are, that it may be multiples of that in the future.
You know, one of the most common questions that trial lawyers ask or wonder about is when it comes to juries and damaged drivers. What factors in your experience drive jurors to come back with plaintiff-friendly verdicts?
There are several. Let me talk about just two, and I'll talk very briefly. One is, because they're really kind of simple context, they're not the level of damages. Those are the level of injuries, which are extremely important. I'm not suggesting diminish those for a moment. But there are several things that drive the jurors to want to compensate for the damages. But the damages and the injuries in themselves don't drive anywhere near as strongly as, say, defendant conduct. The more outrageous the defendant's conduct is, the better. The worse, actually, the more it drives money. So, for example, the client who just bumped into your back bumper of your car, your client's car, that doesn't seem like a really awful thing to do until you point out, which you can do because you're asking them to decide there was negligence, which means you can point out the worst things that very same act could have caused. If your client is stopped at a red light and somebody bumps you from behind at 7 miles an hour, that doesn't seem like a very egregious act until you show them that without the client there, they would have run over the 3 children in the crosswalk. And now texting as you're rolling up to the stoplight is a horrible thing because you can kill children or whatever. And it doesn't have to be things that were in that specific situation. It's the consequences of not looking. What's the worst things that can happen from the wrongful act? So defendant conduct is one of the great drivers. And the other, if you're not really familiar with the laws and how to do this and how to get this stuff in, not going to have time for it today. Maybe we could do another, you know, some kind of session on just this topic. There are other sources to learn about it. Part of the purpose of compensation, and you should be able to tell the jurors this in closing, is deterrence. We want the world to be a safer place for us and our kids. So you're not asking for money to deter. You're asking for money to make your client whole. I'm not sure you should use that phrase. but that's what you're asking for money for compensation. However, you are allowed to say that part of the reason, the public policy that you're allowed to talk about, at least in closing, the public policy for that, the whole doctrine of compensation, is that it will deter future bad conduct by the defendant and others. It's exactly like punitive damages. There are important differences between that and punitive damages, but the goal of compensation is at least half deterrence. And when I first taught that 20 years ago, I probably get laughed off the podium. But, as an outsider to the law, sometimes you spot things that have been neglected for a long time. So those two things are enormous damages conduct. Defendant conduct, by the way, well, let me get not too far into it. These are simply topics you all need to do for future study, but you can start using them basically now.
And I would imagine with all your consulting work around the country, you probably see some common examples of mistakes that plaintiffs' lawyers make.
There is one huge thing that is very frustrating to anybody in this or any business who teaches and writes. It's extremely frustrating. And that is that y'all forget about 90% of what you've read that you liked and what you listen to in seminars and webinars and podcasts and all that. And the reason you forget them is because when you're listening, and you're all probably doing this even now, you're relating what you're hearing directly to a case you're working on, which means you're paying more attention to certain things and not others. And so much of what, and others, the other reason you forget is time goes by and you forget. You know, if you've read any number of books, if you've read 5 or 6 books, if you've read damages, rules, reptile, list whatever your 5, 6, 7, 8 favorite books are. What I'm telling people now, and it's making an enormous difference for them, is once you've read the book once carefully and highlighted it and taken your little notes in the margins, so they'll be there, before, as you're preparing for any new case, not just for trial, but for depositions as well, because you're going to find great arguments to use in depositions. Once you're preparing for any case, take a half a day. Yes, a half a day. I know you don't have a half a day, but this goes to how good you are as a lawyer, and simply quickly page through every one of those books. Topic lists. You don't have to read everything. Just look at the topic list with that specific case in mind. So you quit forgetting things. I cannot tell you how many times I will sit at a seminar and hear somebody say, oh, I got this great new idea. And I don't want to be rude and say, well, it's on page 37 of Rules of the Road, or that's chapter 9 of damages or whatever. And it's been around for years, and I'm watching everybody write it down because they've never thought of it, which means they haven't been using it. And so it's like, anything that happens in college, you remember 5% of later on, unless you use it. So get back to that source you have. Have a special shelf where you keep your special advocacy books and your notes and all of that stuff, your notes from seminars, and scan them to yourself. Review them all quickly to yourself before every single trial, or if you do a lot of the same trials before, kind of trials, before a few of them. There is wonderful stuff out there. I think the proudest achievement of my life is that damages started the fad, I guess it's a fad, of everybody who had good stuff to say, of writing them down or teaching them, writing them down, putting them in books. And now if you look at even a shelf like the biggest one, trial guides, there's dozens of books out there that there's gold in them, their books. So you don't have to buy into every single thing everyone is saying, but the stuff that will be valuable to you, you're the only judge. And you can't judge it if it's flitted out of your head. And I assure you right now, if let's say people say they love damages, they live by it, I assure you if I sat most of those people down and gave them an exam on the important, very valuable stuff that's in that book, they'd all average about a 65%, and you want the other 35%.
I've heard this term premature advocacy.
Yeah.
What does that mean, and why do plaintiffs' lawyers in particular need to be aware of it?
Well, we're the ones, I'm not a plaintiff's lawyer, I'm a consultant, but plaintiff's lawyers are the ones who come in with a bad rap. Tort reform is not dead unless you know how to deal with it in the courtroom, in which case it's dead as a doornail. But if you don't know how to do that, and even if you do, when you first come in, all the myths of tort reform are in the jurors' heads. You are the least credible person in the building. And so when you start with any kind of advocacy, too early, if you have to do mini openings, or if you're in voir dire, or even in the first third or so of opening, if you start asking the jurors to trust you, which you do when you say, let's say you start your opening by saying, this is the case of a driver who didn't look where he's going. Now you've asked me to trust you. You have placed your credibility on the table, gotten me thinking about it when you don't want me thinking about it yet because you haven't been able to establish it yet in trial. So you've placed your credibility on the table when the only decision I can make if I'm most jurors is, oh, you're one of those damn plaintiff's lawyers. Of course you're telling me whatever you're telling me. In other words, I'm not trusting you because of anything you've told me about the case. I'm not trusting you because of anything I've seen about you. I'm trusting you because you're a damn plaintiff's lawyer trying to get a bunch of money. And you lose that battle. And once you've lost that battle by placing your credibility on the table too early, you set up a primacy of belief, which is, this is another one of those damn plaintiff's lawyers, and that primacy of belief can last for the entire trial. Does it kill you all by itself? No, but boy, it's like dodging bullets for the rest of the trial. So don't do it. Hold it off. If you do my version of an opening, the one that's in damages, you start there maybe by the end of part three, which is who we're suing and why. Whatever kind of opening you're doing, don't get into it too early. And yes, you can tell me, oh, I started plenty of trials that way and I did fine. Well, yeah, but let's look at the other ones. Let's look at how much better you would have done if you hadn't done that. The fact that some bad thing has not killed you in trial doesn't mean you should keep doing it again. even if it's worked for you a number of times, this is a much stronger way to go.
And I know I found myself writing opening statements and slipping into advocacy and coming back to one of the images you use in damages, which is, could you see it with a video camera?
Yes.
And that's kind of
the jurors. I'm not going to talk today about it, but if you don't know how to do a process at the beginning of opening called alignment, let me know or let the association know and they will get a hold of me and I will send you the article on how to do alignment. It's probably the most important thing that I've ever developed. And what it does is by the end of the first minute, two, three, four, depending on the case, it has the jury making its own conclusion that, and it's a conclusion, it's almost impossible for the defense to make it go away, that the defendant did indeed do something wrong in this case. And once they're there, for the reasons explained in the article, it is, I hate to say this, it is very hard to lose. I know that sounds like an exaggeration. It's not. Once a juror comes to what they regard as their own conclusion about something, you have set up a power that something is that the defendant did something that has to do with this case wrong, did something negligent, did something bad that hurt somebody. Once they decide that on their own, not because the judge says that's what the case is about, not because you've said it, not anything like that, decide on their own, that is the gold standard for the first 3 minutes of opening, 2, 1, 4, whatever amount of time you need to do alignment. That is the gold standard. If you can do that at the beginning of opening, your career will change. If you can't do it then the battle goes on forever.
So if we're talking about the defendant's conduct right up front, at what point do we get around to telling the story of our own client?
Well, for the same psychological reason, you delay talking about your client. And the reason is this. Jurors are sitting there knowing they have to make a decision. They're looking to be able to make a decision right from the beginning. Being undecided about something is an uncomfortable position. So both consciously and unconsciously, they are working to try to find an easy way to decide the case because then they can relax for the rest of the time. They don't have to listen. And if they don't listen and you're the plaintiff, you're screwed. When you talk about anything first, whatever it is, early on, jurors use that information to make their decision. This is called availability bias. You use the information that you have much more heavily, obviously, than information you don't have. So if you start by saying, here's all the terrible things that happened to my client, and she's in bed, and let's go into her house and look at the terrible shape she's in, and in the sick room, and she got up that morning. On the negligence side, she got up that morning to take her little baby to school and made her husband lunch and had a fight with her neighbor. And then, but no, take out the fight. And did all those nice things because you're trying to humanize her. By the time you get the little kid to school, which is 1 minute before the wreck, the jurors are blaming her. They will find a way to blame her. If you talk about your client too much, the jurors will find a way to blame your client who was sedated under anesthesia on the operating table when the negligence occurred. They will blame your client. And that little piece of blame can grow, but it won't shrink throughout trial. And that can, even if it doesn't cost you the case, takes your verdict way down. Even if there's no comparative issue, it can take your verdict way down because they're just sitting there saying, well, you know, she did this, she did that, and that's probably or maybe what led to it. So I just can't go to the amount of money these folks are asking for. It's an extremely important principle. It's explained thoroughly in the damages book and elsewhere. Please don't fall into that trap. Do not, we don't even let you, if we're working with you and helping you with your opening, we don't even let you use your client's name until after the after alignment, until after the jurors have come to their own conclusion that the defendant did something negligent that hurt her, then you can start using her name. We want no focus at all on your client.
The final topic for today, and we could probably do multiple podcasts on this particular topic, and that is, we live in a remarkable time in American history. How, what kind of sense can we make of the Trump era and its effect on juror attitudes?
Well, first, let me warn you off one thing, and that is the fact that somebody's a Trump juror does not at all make them a bad juror. That'll depend on the issues of the case, just as if they're an anti-Trump juror, that some issues of the case might make them. That's not the problem. The problem is not that Trump or Tro-Prump, or conservative or liberal or whatever, in and of themselves can hurt you in the case. I mean, one of the things we've learned in the past 10 years is that our best jurors, in fact, are conservatives for a whole variety of reasons, and that's an hour seminar in itself, but they are, if you know how to deal with them. What the biggest problem is right now, and it is a growing problem, and I think it's going to get worse and worse no matter what happens in the 2020 election, the polarization of this country has been accomplished. And if it's going to heal, it's going to have to get a lot worse first. And obviously, it's getting worse every day. And it's not going to heal quickly. It's going to take years, maybe a decade or two. Hopefully, it'll happen. How does that polarization affect us doing trials? And it's really quite simple. Jurors look each other up online very quickly these days. I'm sitting next to this guy, let's find out who the hell he is, goes to his Facebook page, finds out his attitudes, yours too, by the way, as well as your website and all that. Keep your political attitudes out of the damn media, off your web page, don't do it. People get upset when I say that. They say, I have my First Amendment rights. Yeah, you do, but you better warn your client before you sign the client up. And if you don't and you've got your opinions on it all there, you better make sure your insurance carriers pay it up because you are hurting your client's case. As far as what's going on the jury, if I, juror number two, figure out that you, juror number three, are on the, and we're both passionate about it, if I am a passionate pro-Trump person, I am not, but let's say I am, it's a big hypothetical, and I find out that you are an anti-Trump person, I'm not going to agree with you about anything. I'm not going to like you. I'm not going to want to go along with you on any topic in the world, certainly not a topic like the one in this case. I don't want to come to an agreement with you bastards. And I'm not saying everybody is like that, but a good 40% of the population, almost every place, falls into that category. And you cannot tell when it's there because you can only question so far into political beliefs. You don't want to question about them so overtly that you initiate the battle right there in voir dire because you can't get rid of all those people. So what you need to do instead is to have an armament of techniques that give the jurors higher priorities with issues involving this case than they do with issues surrounding Trump. Now, just think of what I just said. You need to find things that are more important, more urgent, more pressing, that people care more about than they care about being pro or anti the Trump thing. That is a huge order. We know how to do it. I think I may have taught some of it in an earlier Ohio webinar, but that is material for a different seminar. For right now, what I'm saying is, if you don't know how to do those things, I probably should do an article. I could just distribute to everybody. Maybe I'll try to do that in the next couple of weeks or months or something. At a minimum, Do not ask questions in voir dire that can elicit somebody's political tilt. Is it important to know it? It might be. It is even more important to keep that battle off the jury if you can. We are always susceptible to current events and what's going on in culture and in society, because jurors are all part of that world, and that becomes a large part of their decision-making resources. But this is not like anything I've seen or heard of before. It's sort of like if you were trying to do a trial, and there are great stories on this, in a split state like Missouri just before the Civil War. You better not have pro-North and pro-South jurors on your jury at the same time if you need unanimity. On the other hand, if you're a defense attorney, criminal defense attorney, this may be a good thing. It makes it harder for prosecutors to get convictions. But for those of you doing plaintiff's work, that's not an issue. You need to unify your jury. It's one of the most important trial strategies people learn. I'd say the Spence Ranch, and we teach it in other places, is to bring that jury together. And there's a force out there that has cleaved them in two, many of those juries, before they even come in. So that's where Trump world has left us. This is where you need the best of your techniques that go to things the jurors really care about. You don't discuss this political issue. You come up with techniques that are more important, such as, for example, a current major danger in the community that can be caused by the kind of negligence the defense just did. I can say, if I got to worry about my kid walking to school because of the kind of the thing the defendant did, then I will unite with this son of a bitch who's on the other side of the political thing so that I can try to make sure that happens. That's an example of a unifier, and there's a lot of them.
Well, David, this is fascinating, and we could go on forever. But we appreciate it very much for being here as a guest on our special 50th episode of Civilly Speaking.
Let me say just one more quick thing. Since I've gone so fast, if you have any questions I can answer quickly, I don't have to turn on my consulting clock to do that. Artemis, my partner, Artemis and I like to get questions we can answer quickly. They help us a lot in our teaching and our consulting. I'm at jurywatch, JURYWATCH, at gmail.com. Artemis is ARTEM as in Mary, IS, at consultmmb, like mother basketball, .com, or just contact the association, and they'll tell the Ohio Association, they'll tell you how to get a hold of us. Please don't hesitate to do that. This is not trying to snare you in for consulting. We don't turn on the clock for short answer questions. We love to get them. Thanks very much for asking me to do this.
Thank you, David, and thanks to all our listeners out there. If you like our show and want to learn more, check out civillyspeaking.com, and please leave us a review on iTunes. We'll see you here on the next episode of Civilly Speaking.